good?
Yes.
Okay. Good evening, everyone. Hope you all had an enjoyable Pesach. This week's parsha is Parsha Kedeshim, Tavshin Ayin Tes. We are going to jump around a little bit. I want to start tonight from the end of the parsha. That would be Perikav Pasuk Yitzayin. That would be page 668. That's Perikav, chapter 20, Pasuk Yitzayin, verse 17. So here again, the Torah is going through the Arayas, the illicit relationships, the forbidden relationships that people must obey. And Pasuk Yitzayin reads the following: V'ish asher yikach es achosay, and a man who will take his sister, bas aviv bas imoy, whether the daughter of his father or the daughter of his mother, v'ro'as arvasa, he sees her nakedness, v'yisiras arvasa, she sees his, chesed who? The Torah says it's chesed. V'nichrasu la'ene b'nei amam, they shall be cut off in front of the people of their nation. Arvas achoyse gila, he has revealed the nakedness of his sister. Avira yisa, he shall carry his sin. So of course, the obvious question is, what does this word chesed who mean? Chesed typically means kindness, right? That doesn't seem to fit in here. So Rashi says on chesed who? Chesed who? This is the top Rashi in the left column. Lashon arami cherpa chisuda. The Aramaic word for cherpa, for shame, is chisuda. That's the word in Aramaic. So what Rashi is saying right now is that when the Torah uses the word chesed here, it's not using it in the regular context as it typically does to mean kindness, but it actually means to take the Aramaic word and use that here. It's using the Aramaic form of chesed, which again would actually in other forms be called chisuda. Here the Torah is calling it chesed, using the word Rashi uses is chisuda. And Rashi is saying, well, the word chesed here means that also. It's using the Aramaic form of the word, and it means shame. So chesed who doesn't mean kindness here, it means it's shame, it's shameful. A person who marries, who cohabits with his sister, chesed who, it's a cherpa, it's a shameful thing. That's Rashi's first explanation. Umed Rashi. Then Rashi cites the Medrash. Now Rashi is going to cite the Medrash because it's an obvious question. Okay, so you gave me an explanation what the word chesed means. But why does the Torah use that word here? It's not your typical word to use. Why is it using this word here? And therefore, Rashi cites the Medrash that explains the usage of the word chesed here in the following way. Im taimar kayin nasa achosay. What do you mean? You just told me a man can't marry his sister. Well, who do you think Cain married? Right? Adam, Harishon, had Cain and Hevel. Hevel died. Cain is the one who continued the world until Shays came around. Who did he marry? He had to marry his sister. So how could he marry his sister? The Torah says such a thing is forbidden to do. The answer is, though, chesed asa hamakayim livnais aylami mimenu. Hashem did a kindness for the world to be built from him. There couldn't be a world if he wouldn't marry his sister. So although typically we would say that marrying a sister is a shameful thing, and why would Hashem have Cain do a shameful thing? The answer is it was a dispensation of sort in order to be able to do the kindness of inhabiting the world. So therefore, Rashi's explanation to the word chesed is that the pshat, the interpretation of the pasuk itself, for the word chesed here means it's shameful, using the Aramaic word for shame as chisuda. The reason why the Torah chooses this word chesed over here for shame is because, well, this shameful thing definitely had an element of chesed to it, in the sense that's how the world was able to continue and be inhabited because Cain married his sister. Okay. Now, the commentary of Rabbi Eliyahu Mizrahi, that's a famous commentary on Rashi, gets into a topic that we have discussed before, but he touches on it now, and he asks the following question. that according to the Medrash clearly seems to is clearly saying that if not for this chesed, not for the kindness of the world needed to be inhabited, Kayin could not have married his sister. Meaning, even before the Torah, such a thing would not have been done. Maybe because it's shameful, or because they knew the Torah, but it would be a shameful thing to do. If not for the fact that the world needed it, the Medrash would never allow Kayin to do such a shameful thing. If so, ask the Mizrahi, in Kain Echinia Hashvat the Mashisu Achiseyim. Who did the Yaakov's sons marry? Who did they marry? So, according to the opinion of Rabbi Yehuda in the Medrash, to Umais Noldu im kol Shevet Veshevet, each brother when he was met, each one of Yaakov's sons that were born had a twin sister, Venasim. And they married them. They didn't marry Canaanim, they didn't marry similar that the brothers married Canaanite women, which is kind of strange because, right, Avram didn't want Yitzchak to marry a Canaanite woman. So, but some learn that they did marry Canaanites, and then you have this opinion of Rabbi Yehuda who says they married their sisters. All right, so Kayin had his excuse, he had to inhabit the world. Why did they have to do it? Now, then he goes further. Va'amram, Moshe's father, Yocheved, his wife, what was she? His aunt. How did Amram marry his aunt? If it's clear from the Medrash that the Arayas are something that should not have been done even before the Torah was given. And then even more, right? It all comes down to me, and then it comes down to Yaakov. Yaakov married two sisters. How can he marry two sisters? Two sisters is an erva. It's a lifted form of a relationship. Then he says, the Mizrahi, okay, about Yaakov, maybe we'll say it like this. Yaakov Avinu, he went and he married Rachel and Leah. Maybe we should say that Rachel and Leah needed to be converted. That there was some kind of status, special status that Yaakov had, being from the children of Abraham. Now to bring in someone from the outside, there had to be a certain level of conversion going on. And we know the rule is that a convert is like someone brand new. Brothers, sisters from converts, according to Torah law, they're not considered brothers and sisters anymore. So according to Torah law, we don't allow them to do things still, but the point is that according to Torah law, they're not brother and sister anymore. So maybe you'll say by Yaakov that when he married Rachel and Leah, he converted them. As converts, they're starting a whole new life again. They're like a newborn baby, and they're not sisters. That's who he was able to marry them. So it says in Mizrahi, you know, we have a Gemara again. We have a Gemara that contradicts that. There's a Gemara in Pesachim that talks about that eventually when Mashiach comes, there's going to be a big feast. Yaakov Avinu is going to be invited to lead the benching. He's going to say, no, I can't do it. Why? I married two sisters. That's what the Gemara says. I married two sisters. I can't be the one who lead the benching. So the Mizrahi is saying, from that Gemara you see that you can't say, well, if the point was that he converted them and as converts they started a whole new life and they weren't sisters, then what's Yaakov Avinu saying? I can't do it because I married sisters. Yeah, according to whatever pshat you learn, whatever reason Yaakov Avinu was allowed to marry sisters, Yaakov Avinu was saying, but at the end I married sisters. That's what he's saying. At the end of the day, I married sisters. And therefore, I can't be the one to get this honor. Okay, but if you're going to try to say that Yaakov was able to marry them because they were converts, and therefore they weren't halakhically sisters anymore, then there should be no issue. So therefore, you can't say that. Therefore, says the Mizrahi, we have to follow the answer of the Ramban. The Ramban answers that although we know that the Avos kept the Torah, they only kept the Torah in Eretz Yisrael. This idea of keeping the Torah before the Torah was given, that was only in Eretz Yisrael. In Eretz Yisrael is where they kept to the Torah. Therefore, starting from Yaakov Avinu, when Yaakov married his sister, married Rachel and Leah, where did he marry them? Outside of Eretz Yisrael. Now, some say that the reason why Rachel died before they came to Eretz Yisrael is because once they came to Eretz Yisrael, he came married to two sisters. But let's not go into that right now. But the point is, Yaakov Avinu marries the two sisters because it happens outside of Eretz Yisrael. Okay? Amram marries his aunt. Where did that happen? In Egypt. Okay? Outside of Eretz Yisrael. Okay? And he points out, even though we know that there are mitzvahs that are not dependent on Eretz Yisrael, right? There are certain mitzvahs that they're called chayva saguf. They're an obligation upon the person. No matter where he is, he has to do them. But still, we know that the main place of fulfilling mitzvahs is Eretz Yisrael. Okay, now, we got to go back to the Shvatim now, Yaakov's sons. Okay, Yaakov's sons, where were they living when they married? Where were they living? Eretz Yisrael. They were living in Eretz Yisrael already. So he has to say like this. This is going to have to also suffice to explain how the Shvatim married their sisters. They really weren't living as full-fledged inhabitants of Eretz Yisrael. It was considered a very temporary type of living. They really weren't regular inhabitants. They were like strangers in Eretz Yisrael. Because the decree that Hashem said to Abraham that your children live in a land that's not theirs, that's happening, that's being fulfilled even while they're in Eretz Yisrael. Because even while they're in Eretz Yisrael, living in Eretz Yisrael, not under their own control, but under control of the Canaanim, that is considered for them. They're a ger be'eretz lahem. They're a stranger not in their own land. Well, if they're considered not in their own land, so they may be situated in Eretz Yisrael, but they're not really considered living in a real or permanent or settled manner. They're really considered strangers. They're living in Eretz Yisrael, but they're strangers. And if this is not really their place, then therefore it's like living outside of Eretz Yisrael regarding this idea of fulfilling mitzvahs. I'm just saying what the Mizrahi is saying right now.
They got the Torah, then they got the land. So before it wasn't really the land. They can say where they lived in.
Well, that's an interesting point, but that's really a discussion on its own, because many commentaries say that really Eretz Yisrael belonged to Avraham once Hashem said so. At the same time, this idea, though, how did all these ideas work together? That's a good point. But he's working with the idea that you can say that the children of Yaakov married their sisters because it's not like living in Eretz Yisrael in its truest sense to say that they're living in Eretz Yisrael and therefore they should be abiding by all the laws of the Torah. Okay, that's who explains that. How about Kayin? How do we explain Kayin? Let me explain Kayin. Now again, by Kayin we have a problem, because the whole point of the Mizrahi is that the Medrash says that the only reason Kayin can marry a sister was in order to inhabit the world. If not for that, he couldn't marry a sister. Was he in Eretz Yisrael? Was Kayin in Eretz Yisrael? Was Gan Eden in Eretz Yisrael? Where Gan Eden is that situated in Eretz Yisrael? No.
Where is it?
Somewhere in Iraq. If you follow the way that the Torah gives the boundaries, that's where it would come out. That's where it would come out. Okay? Now, how is the Mizrahi going to deal with Kayin? How is he going to deal with Kayin? So he says, fascinating idea. Can't say I fully understand it. Aval Kayin haya makim dirasei baretz. Kayin's place was, and he basically, where was he living? He was living in Eretz Yisrael. Why? When Adam Arish was created from earth, which earth was he created from? The answer is, based on a Medrash, Eretz Yisrael. Hashem brought Eretz Yisrael dirt to Gan Eden. It was Eretz Yisrael dirt in Gan Eden from which Adam Harishon was created. V'shagurash mi Gan Eden, and when Adam Harishon was chased out of Gan Eden, nata olei apadnoi ba'aretz asher lukach misham. Guess where he went to live? Where did he then, now that once he got thrown out of Gan Eden, where did he go live? Where did he set up shop? The answer is, in the land from where he was taken from, Eretz Yisrael. V'sham noilad Kayin, that's where Kayin was born, v'nish Hashem datzi remit. Those are the words in the Mizrahi. Fascinating idea. So Kayin really should have been keeping the Torah. Or at least, Kayin should not have married his sister, because he'd been Eretz Yisrael. And Eretz Yisrael is where everybody kept the Torah, including Kayin. That's the assumption. The assumption is Kayin also would keep the Torah. He would also, Kayin would also be keeping the Torah. But since he was in Eretz Yisrael, he should also be keeping this law of not marrying his sister. But Hashem basically gave a dispensation that he should be able to marry his sister in order to inhabit the world, which would only, of course, be possible before the Torah was given.
So the Garden of Eden had to be outside Eretz Yisrael.
It was.
Because if you had to leave it,
that's right. Right. How does that all come together? How does Eretz Yisrael get it? I don't know how all these concepts come together. I don't know, but that's what it seems to be. Okay, you know, every time I use the word dispensation, I remind myself of a story. You know, I can't stand using that word. There was one time somebody in my shul. He had a very serious something got into his eye, and his eye got very badly affected. And it was approaching. I don't remember what it was. So, you know, basically he went to the doctor. The doctor said, you know, if something gets worse, he's going to have to call. He has to come to the doctor's office. So this congregant was at the doctor's office, and the doctor called, and he wanted the doctor to speak to me directly about the situation. So the doctor says, basically to me, he goes, Rabbi, so-and-so has this problem with his eye. He can get very serious. You know, if it gets worse, he has to come in. Can you give him a dispensation to come into the office? And I was like, I didn't say it to him, but it was on my tongue to say, I don't give dispensations. I basically explained to him, according to Jewish law, in a situation of danger, he's permitted. But like every time that word dispensation comes, it really gets to me. But that is a word that can be used here, though, because in essence, it's clear that the way the Medrash is saying is that Cain should not have done this. Cain should not have done this, but Hashem allowed it, nor for the world to be inhabited. Okay, so that is Rashi. The Ramban has a different explanation. How do you want the word chesed? And he says that the word chesed here should be used, as it typically is, to mean kindness. But the way he explains it is that there's a word missing here. There's a word missing. Or we have to add a word in the interpretation. And he says there are other places where you find such a thing in the Torah that you have to do that. And therefore, according to the Ramban, the way to read the pasuk is, according to the pasuk Lizayin, a man who takes his sister, the daughter of his father, or the daughter of his mother, okay, chesedhu. Pretend, or imagine this, the word ish chesedhu. He's a man of kindness. Meaning to say, as a brother, he should be a man of kindness. He should be there to help his sister. How does a brother help his sister? He helps her find a husband. That's what she does. That's what he does. So what he should be doing for his sister is being a good brother and taking care of his sister, doing kindness with his sister, and finding her husband. Instead, what does he do? He messes her up. So the pasuk, chesed means kindness. That's what the word here means. But it doesn't mean chesed. Don't translate the chesed as this is a kindness. He married his sister, it's a kindness. That's not the way to read it. But rather, ish chesedhu. He's supposed to be a man of chesed. A brother and a sister. A brother wants to take care of his sister. And instead, and marry her off to someone that she should be married to. And what does he do? He messes her up. So, the word chesed here means kindness, but it means to say chesedhu. He's supposed to be doing kindness with her. And instead, he's ruining her. The Ramban adds that to learn like Rashi, like the other commentaries, that say chesed here really is borrowing the Aramaic word for shame. So he says, Ki rachaku etzli esmilas chesed b'lashon ha-kodesh. It is a distant thing for me to say that the word chesed in the holy tongue, mishamesh behifuchim ha'ela, to be used in such extreme opposites. V'aksu mishabchim ha-mispa'um u'mispa'lo l'mimilas chesed. The psukim are always use the word chesed in a praiseworthy manner. He says also that the form of even the Aramaic form should be different, but the Ramban says he doesn't like learning like Rashi and the other Mefarshim that yeah, the word chesed can be the word chesed in the Torah will be used sometimes in its actually using the Aramaic word for shame, and sometimes it means kindness, the praiseworthy thing. The Ramban says doesn't go for that. And therefore, the word chesed here also should mean kindness, as it always does. But the meaning is chesed, he should have been doing a kindness with his sister to find her husband instead of what he did to her.
He should have been kindness.
He should have been kind. Ish chesed means he's a man, he's supposed to be a person of kindness. The commentary of Aksava Kabbalah cites Rashi, and it brings the Ramban's question, But the Ramban says, you know, to say the word chesed means these total opposites is very strange. Says the Aksava Kabbalah. Nope, it's not a question whatsoever. You know why you could have the word chesed being used in both forms? That's because actually every time a chesed takes place, there's something shameful taking place also. There's shame occurring. The recipient feels shame. When you do a chesed, when you do a kindness, and the Torah uses kindness in the proper form, the Torah is saying, yeah, the Torah is praising you for what you did. But the Torah is all, but at the same time, there is something else that unfortunately happens when you do a kindness with someone. That person feels a certain shame that he needs to come on to others. So kindness and shame go together. They're not complete opposite things. They go together. And therefore, says the Ksava Kabbalah, to basically answer Rashi, that when Rashi says that the word chesed here means shame, it's not like, whoa, like shame. Chesed always means kindness, doesn't it? It does. And the word here of chesed is the same word of kindness. But here we're using that word that's used for kindness for the other element that exists by kindness, which is shame for the recipient. Therefore, here too, we can use the word chesed to mean shame for this act. And as Rashi says, you want to know why use the word chesed here? So it's alluding to what the Medrash says. But the whole point of the Ksava Kabbalah is the fact that the word chesed is not being used in two opposite interpretations, but rather being used, the word chesed, it's the same word as always. But every word chesed carries in it the idea of shame because there's a certain feeling of shame on the part of the recipient of the kindness. And therefore, he says, you can use the word chesed here, because here we're using it for the connotation that lies within the word chesed all the time. Okay, so I wanted to focus on that. This is not usually a part of the parsha that we get a chance to talk about. And therefore, I wanted to talk about this before we go back to the beginning. All right, let's go back to... Again, right now we're not going to go exactly in order. But take a look on page 660. This is Perek Yotes, chapter 19, Pasuk Yudches, verse 18. Do not take revenge, do not bear a grudge against the people of your nation. You shall love your friend as yourself. Ani Hashem, I am Hashem. Love your friend as yourself. The Ramban says to mean whatever you want for yourself, you want the stuff you should want for someone else. You want to be treated respectfully, you should treat people the same way you want to be treated. That's how the Ramban says, love your friend as yourself. The Ramban says you can't actually come to a point of loving your friend as you would love yourself, but it means basically deal with him the way you would want to be dealt with. Love him like yourself. Whatever you want for yourself, you should want for someone else. Will you want it as much as you want it for yourself? Not necessarily, but whatever it is that you want for yourself, love for someone else. I want to share with you a very interesting thought from Rabbi Label Lamb. He's a Rav in Muncie, and he writes the Rav Tarek every week. And he brings down the following story. It's a fascinating insight. And it starts with someone that he knew in Eretz Yisrael who grew to be a very big Talmud Chacham. At one point of life, he was in university and he was pursuing a doctorate in philosophy. And his professor made the following bold declaration. The Jewish Bible is the source of human rights in the world. Sounds good. Okay. All the students wrote it down in a notebook. But the one Jew in the class, which was this young man, he actually challenged his teacher and he said, could you tell me where that's written in the Torah? Where is it written in the Torah, the verse that promises human rights? So the professor was taken back. I mean, everybody knows Jewish Bible is a source of human rights. So the professor says to him, do you disagree? He says, no, I agree. I just want to know the source. I want to know the source. Okay, well, basically the professor now had to go try to figure out where in the Jewish Bible is the source for human rights. Couldn't find it. Comes back a week later, admits can't find a verse in the Torah that guarantees human rights. He's looking for a pasuk that says every human being has human rights. And he said, you know, basically, you know, forget about that he didn't know. He asked people in the history department, literature department, sociology department. You know, he asked them the same question. Is it true that the Jewish Bible is a source for human rights? They all said yes, but nobody knew the source. So at that point, the professor said to the student, do you have a source? So the student said, yes. Let's take, for example, a verse in the Jewish Bible that the great Rabbi Akiva said that this verse is Klal Gadol Batara. It's a great principle in the Torah. And that is, V'ahavta l'rayacha kamecha, love your friend as yourself. So we're all commanded, love your friend as yourself. The implication of that statement is that everyone has a right to be loved. When I walk into a room where you are obligated to love your neighbor, I have a right to be loved. If you're obligated to love me, I have a right to be loved. But he didn't stop there. The only difference is that the Torah never came as a bill of rights, rather as a bill of responsibilities. Meaning, the idea of this human rights to be loved is not, the Torah doesn't say it as a right, the Torah says it as a responsibility. And therefore, this person continued, I don't know if he continued saying it to his college professor or not, but he continued with the idea of, so think about it, you know, imagine how much more love exists in a relationship when both parties know what they owe in love as opposed when each demands their rights to be met. Right? There's going to be a difference between a love between people when people look at love as it's their responsibility to love one another, then basically, I have a right. I have a demand to be loved. I have a demand to be treated in a certain way. How much more love is in the room when every member of a family knows that they are duty-bound to love and happily contribute? How much greater an entire community or a nation can be when it is composed of individuals who live up to this universal notion and categorical imperative to love your neighbor as yourself? Compare that to a world of persons seeking only their rights. The point being is that the human right means this is something you can demand. It's being presented as a right. It's something you can demand. The Torah doesn't phrase it that way. The Torah doesn't present it that way. The Torah presents it as a responsibility from one to another. And there's a big difference when the way that a person is loved because of the fact that he is receiving love from a person who feels responsibility to give the love. Because if I have responsibility to love, you have a right to give the love. You know, I may have a human right, right? I have a right. You have a right. So because we both demand it, you know, we have a right to demand. You have to answer to my demand. The Torah is not framing this as my demand, my right, but rather responsibility to each other. And when the love that is given as a responsibility to one another, that creates a whole different, environment, an environment where everybody's demanding love. Everyone's demanding their right. When you demand your right, it's selfish. When love is presented, when love is presented as a responsibility from one to another, which means everybody is giving, not taking, it's a whole different environment. That's the real way that love is going to be developed. When people give to each other, that's the real source of love. But when people are walking around demanding rights, then it's really about taking. Taking is not going to be the source of a world of true love. So I thought it was a really very, very fascinating idea about the way that v'ahavta l'rayacha kamecha, love your friend as yourself. At the end, does it mean you have a right to be loved? Yes. But the right comes from the fact that I have the responsibility to you. That's how it's seen. It's about a responsibility.
Even if I don't like you?
Excuse me?
That's a separate discussion.
But right, even if I don't like you. Hey, listen, you can demand human rights if the other person doesn't like you either. That's typically when you demand human rights. But the point is that when the whole idea of human rights is framed within comes out within a framework of responsibility to give, responsibility to love, then that whole environment is not an environment of taking, an environment of giving. And that is where true love develops. Now, once we're talking about friendship, it's worthwhile to talk about, to bring in a saying from Pirkei Avos. And the saying from Pirkei Avos is, it says, Asei lecha rav, make for yourself a rav, a teacher, ukenei lecha chaver, which literally translated means, and acquire or buy for yourself a friend. So that sounds kind of, that doesn't sound right. You're not supposed to buy friends. What does it mean, ukenei? So Rabbeinu Yoina actually explains that kenei means to buy, it means to acquire. And what it means is that if in order to gain a friendship, you have to give up from yourself, even if it means giving up from your money, if it's a worthwhile friend, yes. Now, what does that mean? It doesn't mean you walk over to the guy and try to buy him. But sometimes it's you have to actually spend some money in order to create a friendship. You know, it could be worthwhile taking out someone to eat if it gives you a chance to develop a friendship. It could be worthwhile buying someone something. It could be while giving somebody a gift. It could be while paying for something for someone if that's going to help your friendship. So kenei, in the sense of actual buying, right? Meaning, kenei means acquire. Typically, kenei acquire means buying something with money. Yeah, it means if it's necessary to acquire the friend, you have to give up money for it. You give up money. Doesn't mean you go and throw money at him and be my friend, pay him to be your friend. But it means if in order to acquire this friend, this true friend, it means you have to acquire him with money, you got to give up money to do so, you should do that. But the Rabbeinu Yoina doesn't stop there. Rabbeinu Yoina says another way of buying a friend, another way of acquiring a friend. My understanding of Rabbeinu Yoina is that the word acquire, he's learning as a connotation of giving up from yourself in order to get the friend. So you can give up your money to acquire something. When it comes to a friend, you can give up from yourself to acquire a friend. It means give up from your patience, from your tolerance, from the fact that when he annoys you or gets on your nerves or did something wrong to you, you let it go because it's worth keeping the friendship intact, even though sometimes he may not be doing the right thing to you. Kenei here means give up from yourself. It can mean give up from your time. It can mean give up from your patience and tolerance. You know, he's done something to you and it's really getting to you and you want to just, you know, basically lash back out at the person for what he said or he did. And the answer is no, you keep calm, you speak quietly, you're tolerant, you're patient, you're giving up. That's the way you give up for a friend.
How does he learn if he keeps doing that?
Good, so you have to find the right way of saying it. But the point is that you need, if you want to keep that friendship going, you need to give up, in a sense, give up from you acquire him by speaking calmly, pleasantly, being patient. You're giving up from yourself in order to acquire the friend. Rabbeinu Yoina also now talks about what are friends for, right? Love your friend as yourself, right? What are friends for, right? Ultimate question, what are friends for? Rabbeinu Yoina says friends are for three things. Number one, friends are for studying Torah together. When you have someone to study Torah with, that is how you gain greater understanding of the Torah. There's a famous saying from Rebbe. Rebbe said, I learned a lot from my teachers, more from my friends, and the most from my students. But more from my friends, from a study partner, from a friend. When you study with someone together, that helps you understand better. That's one thing a friend is for. Another thing a friend is for, says Rabbeinu Yoina, is to help you in mitzvahs. Help you in mitzvahs means that actually he'll rebuke you when you do something wrong. He will actually go over to you, he sees you doing something wrong, and he'll tell you you're doing something wrong. And you know what? And when he does something wrong, you're going to tell him also. And even if he's not perfect, but he means to help you get on the right path, you're going to take that, you're going to take that act of friendship and use it to do tshuva. But now, as friends that are rebuking each other and helping each other get on the right path, together you'll do tshuva. So another thing that a true friend is for is actually keeping you, having someone that's ready to keep you on the right path. And even if he's not perfect, and you're going to keep him on the right path, and together you'll do tshuva. That's number two, says Rabbeinu Yoina. And number three, a true friend is an advisor, a supporter, and a confidant. Someone that you could speak to, someone you can trust will will keep secrets when you ask him to, that he'll be private with the kind of things that you reveal to him, someone who is, you're comfortable, someone who's ready for you to be able to spill, to let out what you need, and he'll keep it private. That's the third thing. He calls it a confidant. That's his idea.
Wife too, no?
There's something about a friend. Something about a friend.
You're talking about the same sex friend.
Yes, we're talking about a friend. If there's something about a friend that you can go to and you can talk to him, you can spill your gut, you can reveal secrets, you can reveal things that are bothering you, and trust that he's not going to go tell it to other people. That's what makes a good friend. A friend who studies Torah with you, keeps you in line, and is a confidant. Okay. Let's now talk about the first half of the pasuk. First half of this pasuk reads, this is again pasuk Yudches, Loisikaim veloisitaras b'nei amecha. Do not take revenge, do not bear a grudge against the people of your nation. So the Kliyakar, so again, what does revenge mean? Revenge means, the Gemara says, revenge means if Reuven says to Shimon, lend me your sickle, Shimon says no, then Shimon goes to Reuven and says, lend me your axe, and Reuven says, no way, you didn't lend me your sickle, I'm not lending you my axe. Basically, retaliation. Okay. What is losita, don't bear a grudge, mean? Don't bear a grudge means, an example, an illustration of bearing a grudge would be where Reuven asks Shimon for his sickle. Shimon says no. Shimon goes back, Reuven says, lend me your axe. And Reuven says, I will lend you my axe. Not like you didn't want to lend me your sickle, but I'll lend you my axe. Now that's a little bit, you know, overdoing it. It doesn't have to be necessarily in that form, but it's the point you're bearing a grudge. Even if you're not going to retaliate against the person, but you're bearing a grudge. And therefore, and the Torah is actually forbidding bearing a grudge. So that's the thing. Don't take revenge. Don't bear a grudge. So the commentaries talk about, why shouldn't you take revenge? Why not? Why should you not take revenge?
Not for you.
Why?
Well,
feels good, doesn't it? Isn't it geschmack?
No, but
sweet revenge.
Revenge, it's like living in somebody's brain or something. It takes a lot out of the person.
Okay, it takes a lot out of you. It's a vicious cycle. Okay, I want to share with you how the Kliyakar explains it. The Kliyakar explains that, first of all, he points out this. The word, when the Torah says, don't take revenge or don't bear a grudge, it says, Loisikar loisitar espenei amecha. The people of your nation. The next part of the pasuk says, love your friend as yourself. And a lot of times, if you want to use the word, there's a word for friend that relates more to the word am, nation, as amischa, amisecha. Those mean friends. Now, the Kliyakar is focusing on why for people, I mean, don't take revenge from another person, why does the Torah use these words, b'nei amecha, the people of your nation? It doesn't say your friend, it says the people of your nation. So he says the answer is because there are going to be certain times, the point is to say like this. Sometimes a person could be a Russia. He could be an evil person. And he's not considered one of your friends. You don't have to return a lost object to him. A lot of the responsibilities we have to one another, if the other person is a Russia, we don't have those responsibilities. But I understand the Kliyakar correct. He's saying like this. B'nei Amecha means the people of your nation. Any fellow Jew, any person of B'nai Amecha, whether he's Toiv, whether he's Ra, he's a good person, he's a bad person, that person is someone that we say, don't take revenge from. You know why don't take revenge? Because what did he do wrong to you? What did this person do wrong to you? Basically, he went ahead, he harmed you physically, he harmed you monetarily, maybe he embarrassed you, he insulted you. But at the end of the day, did he try to hurt your neshama? Did he try to destroy your neshama? He's not trying to destroy your neshama. If he tries to destroy your neshama, it's a different ballgame from the way the Kliyakar makes it sound like. If it's he's trying to destroy your neshama, then you better then stand up against him and take care of him. But if at the end of the day, this person is a Russia, he insulted you, he stole your money. He's a Russia, he stole your money, right? Now do you want to get back at him? You don't get back at him. Because if the only thing he harmed was your physical essence, the only thing that they basically harmed you was in a physical manner, not in a spiritual manner, that you don't take revenge for. Why? Because at the end of the day, the matters of your body are really not important enough to take revenge. The whole idea of not taking revenge is that what this person did to you, it's just not worth getting it's not worth, it's, the whole thing is, what are you getting back to him for? What did he do to you? He went ahead and he took some money from you, even if he took a lot of money from you, which hurts, but at the end of the day, you have to look at it as, it's only money. It's only money. Compared to what really, really matters in life, these things don't matter. That you have to now go hurt a person back for that. And he brings down that at the same time, you have an example of a Talmud says, Kol shal Talmud Chacham she'en enoikim enoikim kenachash en a Talmud Chacham. If a Torah scholar doesn't take revenge, like a snake, he's not a Talmud Chacham. What's he taking revenge for? Somebody shamed him. There, the pshat is, do you know why the Talmud Chacham has to take revenge for when he's shamed? Not because of himself personally. He represents the Torah. The Torah was shamed. He has to stand up for the honor. He has to avenge the honor of the Torah. So to avenge the honor of God, that you can avenge. But your own honor, you can't avenge. Your own loss, you can't avenge. Because your physical loss is not important enough to take revenge. That's what the Torah is trying to say. Don't get so worked up about what happened here. And he continues. And he says, anything that happens to a person physically, the Rebbeinu doesn't want you retaliating for it. What is this comparable to? You have this child, and he makes this beautiful sandcastle. He works out a sandcastle. Or he works hard and he makes this major Lego project, okay? Uba is the Adam, and some mean guy comes over. He ruins the whole thing, knocks down the whole thing. Mean, the whole thing. And the kid is screaming bloody murder. Daddy, you got to get this guy. You got to beat him up. You got to kill him. If his father would pay attention to this kid and do what the kid wants, he'd kill the guy. The father, hopefully he'll be, you know, show some sympathy to his kid, but he's not listening to his kid at all. Because even if the child in his immaturity thinks this is the end of the world, The father knows it's just not that way. It's not worth making a fuss about it. Because truthfully is, the guy didn't do anything. Now again, if he's picking on your kid, you do something about it, okay? But if it's like some other kid who just goes ahead and sees it and smashes it, you know, you're going to make a fuss about it. It's not such a big deal. He says, that is how the Rabbanu Shel Olam wants us to look at things. And he says, interestingly, Kachu Inyan Ben Avinu Shemashmem Lebruav. There's a similar thing between Hashem and His creations. Shelaviyat Miut Hasagasim Muskalis, because they lack the true perspective of what really counts, Heim Chayshvim Kikolin Yonei Ha'ilam Azeh, they think that all matters of this world, Yesh Bem Tzad Maila Ushlemus, That's where the importance lies. And anybody who touches their honor, bodies, or money, they see it as the biggest crime. What do? They do? They happen to Hashem. Get back at him. The Hashem doesn't necessarily listen to that. If it doesn't involve a person's neshama, the Rebbeinu Shel Olam, he says, l'pa'amim, times, he's not going to respond. Ki be'enei Hashem yisvar, achar le'inyanim asher b'nei ha'adam, misag l'mehem b'elam hazeh, der m'mamash l'tzchayk, u'tzchayk, asher osaloi hayol shizkaru. Because all matters that go on between people in the eyes of Hashem, it's really like the kid in his sandcastle. Okay, in a Kadosh Baruch Hu mashkiach b'hem zulas b'zman shal yidei mu'urish shebegufa yisigilu bitl teiro mitzvah, ozana kam in nikmas Hashem. When would the Rebbeinu Shel Olam allow, or maybe say even get involved? If it comes out that by him stealing money from you, right, you're not able to serve Hashem properly. If he physically hurts you, or he harasses you, or whatever it is, he's literally holding you back, he's affecting your neshama, that's already a different ballgame. Then you've got to do something back to him to stop. And maybe the Rabbanim Shalom will get involved in that situation. But the idea of the prohibition of forbidding, whether it be revenge, whether it be bearing a grudge, the idea is that if you retaliate against someone for what somebody did to you, that means that you feel that what you lost out on was important enough that now you have to get back at him. And the point is, there is nothing in this world, in the physical world, that's important enough that you should actually retaliate for. That whether we realize it or not, that's the truth. On the other hand, says the Kli Yakar, if we're talking about a situation where you're retaliating because you're standing up, revenging the honor of Hashem, which means because the person has shamed the Torah, or the person is actually hurting other people spiritually, he's holding back other people from serving Hashem, that can be a different answer about how you have to deal with that kind of person. But in the sense of your physical kind of loss, the Torah's point of don't retaliate is the idea it's not worth it. As much as it hurts, it's not worth it. Nothing in this world is physical. Nothing in the physical world is really worth it. It's really worth retaliating. Clearly, no one has the right to take it away from you. You should stand up for yourself when you need to. But at the end of the day, if at the end of the day you lost it, you've got to realize it's just not anything in this physical world is just not worth it. Just not worth it. Okay. Last thing I'm going to talk about today is Pasuk, again in this perek. We'll turn a few pages. This is Perek Yates, Pasuk Lamed Vav, page 664. Perek Yates, chapter 19, verse 36. Actually, let's go back to Lamed Hey 35. Lo yisasu avel b'mishpat, you shall not commit wrongdoing in judgment, b'mida, b'mishkol, b'mesura, in measures of length, weight, or volume. Meiznei tzedek, avnei tzedek, you should have correct scales, correct weights, eifa tzedek, vihin tzedek, a correct dry measures, correct liquid measures shall be to you. Ani Hashem Elokeichem, Hashem your God, Asher Hotzeisi Eschem Be'er Me'eretz Mitzrayim, who took you out from the land of Egypt. So this is the Torah's obligation of having honest scales. The Torah specifically deals that when you're dealing with measuring, you have to make sure that everything is honest and working properly. To cheat a person through inappropriate measuring processes is, the Torah is saying, is forbidden. So to have a scale that's off, to cheat on a scale, whatever ways people cheat on scales, is forbidden to do. The Yaakov Mayam Lays brings the following story. That there was a city that was suffering from a drought, and the Rebbe of the city decreed 3 days of fasting and praying, but it wasn't helping. Still no rain. And the situation was really, really dire. So the Rebbe had a dream. In the dream he was told that no rain will fall unless Chaim, the storekeeper, leads the community in davening. Now when you had a fast day, they had a, you know, they used to put up prominent people to be the chazan, to be the representative, the shliach tzibur, to be the one that would lead the davening. And typically, if the person is considered a illustrious person, it's supposed to be a merit for the prayers to be answered. Well, that wasn't happening. And in the dream, the Rav gets a dream, no rain unless Chaim the storekeeper leads the davening. So the Rav wakes from the dream. He says, can't be. Chaim the storekeeper? He's an Amaretz Gomer. He's an absolute ignoramus. Absolutely. He knows practically nothing. How could he be the one that should be the Shliach Tzibur? He should lead the davening. So he thought it was just a meaningless dream. But the dream occurred again, and he understood that it's a sign from Shemayim. Chaim has to be the Shliach Tzibur. He has to be the one to represent the community. All right? So the Rav then announced again to the community that everyone should gather together in the shul to daven for rain. And when he was asked who's going to be the shliach tzibur, who's going to lead the davening, he didn't answer. Because if he gave an answer, you can only imagine what the reaction was going to be. Everybody the next day comes and gathers. The Rav announces, Chaim, you come and be the shliach tzibur, you lead the davening. The people were astonished. Chaim himself was shocked out of his mind, and he basically said, "He said, Rav, what are you making fun of me? I barely know how to say Shema. How can I be the one that's going to lead the davening, especially when so many other prominent people led it and it didn't work?" The Rav said, "Chaim, there is no one else. Do whatever you can." At that point, Chaim pulled off his talis, took off his tefillin, and ran out of shul. And everybody waited to see what was going to happen. Chaim comes back to shul with the scale from his store in his hand. And a scale was a scale that it had the middle stick, and it has the two cups hanging from the side. So he takes the scale, and he says, standing up in front of everyone, he says, "Ribbono shel Olam, Master of the Universe, the two pans on each end of the scale represent the two letters Hey of your holy name. The rod in the middle on which they hang represents the letter Vav. The hook on top, which holds up the scale, represents the letter Yud." So he's saying, in the scale lies Hashem's holy name of Yud Kei Vav Kei. And then Chaim continued, "If I have cheated anyone with this scale and desecrated your holy name, may a fire come down and burn me. But I have never cheated anyone. I pray before you, Ribbono shel Olam, please bring the rain. Please bring rain to the people who cry out to you in the merit of this mitzvah." And shortly afterwards, the rain came. And the Rav said to the people, he said, "Look, see how serious honesty in our scales and measures have to be. So many prominent people led the davening, were not answered, while Chaim was. This chus, this merit of having honest weight, and to be able to declare that I have never, ever cheated anyone, that was the merit to bring the rain." So, can we explain the connection here? What was it about his honesty in weights and scales, in weights and measures, that was the merit by which he was able to, that the Ribbono shel Olam would bring rain? Is there a connection between the two? So I wanted to suggest the following. The Netziv in Devarim, in Parshas Kisetze, where again this mitzvah is mentioned again about having honest weights and measures, the Netziv differentiates between cheating someone with inaccurate weights and measures and stealing. Now they're both a form of stealing, but the difference is like this. Stealing, in which I go ahead and I grab something of yours, is something that you may do out of passion. You see something, and you just got to have it. So you steal it. It's not so much an expression of a lack of emunah. I mean, to a degree it is, but a lot of times it's just you're overcome by passion, a desire for something, and you can't control yourself. You can't hold yourself back. When a person cheats in weights and scales, which means he's really very methodical and working out things, he's not acting impulsively, he's acting very intentionally, okay? That's a person. Why is he doing it? Because in his mind, I got to make a buck. It's a jungle out there. And whatever it takes to make a buck, I got to do. If I don't make the money, someone else is going to make the money. I got to make the money. When you cheat someone in weights and scales, it's really a sign of your lack of faith, of emunah in Hashem. That shows that you don't believe the Ribbono shel Olam runs the world. And because you don't believe the Ribbono shel Olam runs the world, you got to do whatever it takes to make a buck. But if you truly had the proper emunah and betachem, the Ribbono shel Olam, proper faith and belief in the Ribbono shel Olam, you wouldn't do this. A person who, let's say, is overcome by passion, by desire, okay, but that's not what a person like that, this person is like. This person is basically very methodical, he's very intentional, and sure, he loves money. Sure, he loves money. But at the end of the day, if this is what you're doing, if this is how far you go, it really shows you're going this far because you feel this is what you need to do to make a living. If this is what you feel you must do, you must cheat people to make a living, that's a complete lack of faith and trust in Hashem. Therefore, Chaim the storekeeper, right, who has never cheated anyone, clearly had a very, very high level of emunah and bitachon Hashem. A person who's going to be so meticulous, so careful, that he can go ahead and say in front of Ribbono shel Olam, "I never cheated anyone," and because of that, Ribbono shel Olam responds to his merit, to his chesim, then that means that he was truly a person who had true emunah and bitachon in Hashem. And the power of emunah and bitachon is actually a power that could bring about Hashem's response to our needs. There's a Gemara by Metzia that talks about there was a sage, Reb Chiya, and his sons. They were very special people. And it seems like Eliyahu HaNavi, if I remember the story correctly, Eliyahu HaNavi revealed, I think it was to Rebbe the Hanasi, that if Reb Chiya and his children would daven, they would daven the Shemayna Esrei as representing the Tzibur, they could bring Mashiach. They could bring Tchiyas HaMeisim. So when Rebbe heard this, he said, okay, let's go for it. So he got Reb Chiya and his sons, and he got them to daven, all four of them together. They were davening, they were leading the tefillah. That's my understanding of the Gemara. They were leading the tefillah. So the Gemara says, when they got to Mashiv HaRuach, what happened? The wind blew. Marid HaGeshem, the rain came down. Okay? They're about to say, Mechayim Mesim. Well, actually, they said it before. Well, it says it before too. Okay, but the Gemara says they were going to say they're about to say Mechayim Mesim. And in Shamayim, they were going wild. Like, whoa, it's not time for this yet. And the Gemara says that they gave lashes to Eliyahu HaNavi. They said, you better go do something. So before they had a chance to say Mechayim Mesim, it says he came down and he disrupted the whole thing. He basically disrupted their kavana, their concentration. And he got it, and he was able to stop the whole thing. So the question is asked, the Sefer Shabbat asks, but, you know, if they were asking for rain, if they were asking for Tchiyas HaMeisim, okay, Hashem would respond. But they weren't in the part of Shemana Esrei where you make requests. They were in the part of Shemana Esrei where they mention Hashem's mighty deeds. There was no request here. So why was all this happening when they said that? Says the Shari Ayra, what you see from here is that if you, when you have true emunah in betachin, in Rabbanu Shalom for something, that is what Hashem will respond to. Reb Chiya and his sons, their emunah in betachin, their emunah in Hashem, that Hashem makes the wind blow, was so great, was so clear, that emunah evokes from Hashem a response of the wind. Their emunah in betachin and Hashem in rain evokes a response of Hashem for rain. Well, their emunah in Hashem for Tchiyas HaMeisim was so great and so real that emunah would have created the response from Hashem for that, and therefore they have to be disrupted. And therefore the Shari Ayra says, you know, by all the brachas that we say where we make a request from Hashem in Shemayna Esrei, so we ask for knowledge. What do we end up saying? Baruch Atah Hashem Chayin Ados. Bless you Hashem, the one who bestows knowledge. Why does every request end off with this statement that Hashem is Baruch, Hashem is the source for everything? Go make your request. I'm coming to you, Rebbe Shalom. I need this, 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 and this, and this. Am I not coming to you because I believe that you're the source of it? But the Chazal, when they made the brachas, they wanted at every request to actually also state that this request comes from Hashem. Why did they want that for? The answer is because those statements at the end are meant for you to strengthen your trust and belief in Hashem in this manner. And that will be the source by which the request will be granted. So yes, there is something about when you make the request, that alone shows that you believe that Hashem is the source. But by after making the request, you kind of repeat explicitly, Hashem is the source. That emunah, that faith in Hashem that you now strengthen within you, that itself now creates the merit for the response. Therefore, Chaim was the one who brought the response from Hashem, because if he had that high level of trust and faith in Hashem, that Hashem is the source of all livelihood, he's the one who has the merit to be able to bring rain at the source of livelihood for all the people in the community.
But he knew, after thinking about it, that was the reason why he was supposed to daven, because over the years, he must have felt, you know,